Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 14th, 2006. Our session today is entitled Creative Incentives for Business to Act Responsibly. Part 1. Our presenter is Steve Balls. Session number BAHS 2006-1. Let's listen in.
Well, once again, my name is Steve Balls, right now I'm the president of Augustana College, but I'd like to tell you about how I became interested in this particular subject matter. I started out my career as a lawyer. It's great to see so many lawyers here. I'm a recovering lawyer, having moved into academics and college administration, but I practiced corporate law in Milwaukee, so I had a similar experience. You represent clients and you have some questions about some of the contact and some of the conduct. Your job is to represent them, and you kind of wonder what your role is. I was very active in the Greater Milwaukee Council of Churches as the Council of Churches looked at social responsibility issues and got a call at my office one day that the Milwaukee County prosecutor was going after a pastor in West Allis at a Presbyterian church there. A parishioner had slid underneath his door a confidential report from Alice Chalmers, which is a manufacturer of tractors. You remember Alice Chalmers tractors, the main employer in that town, West Allis. And the prosecutor took the position that he was in possession of stolen property. This probably was slipped under the door by a parishioner. The report contained plans about closing the plant, potentially closing the plant, and when the company might close the plant, what steps they would go through. And in that plan was that if the plant is closed, it'll be closed without much notice because they didn't want to have any labor problems. So the pastor then went to the local press about this, and that angered Alice Chalmers Corporation and angered certainly the Milwaukee County prosecutor. Now, we made enough noise, our law firm as an attorney, to get those charges dropped. It was clearly overreaching. It wasn't a crime. He had no knowledge necessarily that it was a stolen document or a non-public document. A pastor was simply stepping forward in his position trying to assist his parishioners, many of which were Alice Chalmers employees. But we decided to fight back a little bit on that. The church actually owned some stock in their endowment fund in Alice Chalmers Corporation. So we decided to file a shareholders resolution. I had never done that before. I was sitting on the side of corporations, not shareholders. And it was an interesting experience. The shareholders resolution, I thought, was a relatively modest one. And that was that the shareholders asked Alice Chalmers, this tractor manufacturer, to give 180 days notice before they left the community and to work with the community in developing some sort of package for the community to rebound from the loss. A fairly modest proposal. Didn't say you couldn't close your plant. Simply said we want notice and we want you to do something for the community, or at least negotiate about doing something for the community. Not that you can't leave, and not that you have to do X, Y, or Z. Well, that was a learning experience for me. What I thought would happen is that they would begrudgingly put the resolution before the shareholders and vote it down. I figured we'd get 1 or 2% of the vote, but I thought, well, it's kind of an interesting experience. In fact, they wanted to negotiate with us, negotiate with this church. We flew two representatives of the Greater Milwaukee Council of Churches to New York, the corporate headquarters, where their attorneys were, and negotiated a package. And that package was that Alice Chalmers would agree to give 90 days notice before closing the plant. Now, not earth-shaking a notice, but it was notice that was important for that community and notice that was important for the workers. They, in fact, did close the plant and gave 90 days notice. They did not negotiate a package with the community, but Alice Chalmers was under severe financial problems there. So I thought that's kind of neat. You know, here is a small church, small Presbyterian church, that can make a real difference. So corporate responsibility has been a real interest of mine since then. I thought what we would do today is talk a little bit about how decisions are made within businesses and how businesses balance the interests of various stakeholders, and what managers of those businesses can do, if those managers are people with a social conscience, to help manage those businesses and balance those interests in a way that would be very, very successful. I should note before we do that, on the back of the, and tomorrow, incidentally, tomorrow morning, for those of you who are still around, what we're going to do is session number one, or unit number one, of this evening's. Since many of you will be leaving, we're going to do the last unit then tomorrow morning. That is, what can we do as consumers, as shareholders, and so on, to encourage responsibility? Next week, for those of you who are around, we'll get into a little more of the meat of it. We'll talk about outsourcing, we'll talk about responsible corporate conduct in third world countries, we'll talk about drafting corporate codes of ethics that work, and we'll talk about corporate responsibility for corporations acting in third world countries where there is no effective system of law. So we'll focus a little internationally next week, a little more domestically this week. Well, here are the stakeholders of a corporation. Do I have them all up there? Shareholders or owners of the business, managers and shareholders don't always have the same owners of the business, managers and shareholders don't always have the same at the expense of the shareholders. Employees, certainly customers, suppliers, government, and the community. And there may be others. I think that corporations and businesses have a duty for competitors, for example, to act fairly. There may be others. Have I gotten all the stakeholders up there for corporations?
Would you consider, say, banks or financial?
Sure. Yeah, I think so. Certainly, yeah, creditors. Some creditors are suppliers, but many are not.
You might add environment.
Sure.
Since we're old.
Do trees have standing?
It's a good question. there's some law about that. So in the United States, given the status of our law, what are the primary duties of a business? Who do you owe the duty to? Now, don't you see that those duties are conflicting duties, are they not? What is good for the environment is not necessarily good for the shareholders. What's good for suppliers might not be good for customers. What's good for management may or may not be good for employers or employees. Where's the duty in the United States?
The owners.
To the owners. Yeah, to the owners.
To the stockholders. To the stockholders.
Yeah, to the stockholders. That is very clearly a duty. Now, most of us take that as a given. It's probably that way all over the world. It is not that way all over the world. The United States and England are almost in a class of their own in that regard, with the primary duty being toward the owners. I've taught about corporate responsibility in Germany, for example, to law students. German law students just can't understand these high salaries the corporate management has in the United States. They can't understand why there isn't a greater duty to the employees. And they can't understand why there isn't a greater duty to the community. When you charter a corporation in Germany, that a corporation is for the good of the community and can be dissolved by the state if it does not act in the good of the community. Now, in smaller countries, in Middle Eastern countries, corporations are largely unknown. Large businesses are often state businesses. Most businesses throughout the Middle East and Southeast Asia, for example, are small family-owned businesses. The dynamic is very different there. When a business is connected with the family and the family name, you look at duties to your neighbors a little differently. You have to live with these people. Here there is the separation, of course, of ownership and management in the United States, and it is quite different. Well, I indicated on the syllabus that I want to talk a minute about Dodge versus Ford. Some of the attorneys in the room will remember that case from their corporate law course. I won't call on you to recite the case, and the holding notes, very hard not to. Dodge versus Ford really kind of establishes the rules for corporations in the United States. This particular case was decided in 1919 in the state of Michigan, as you might expect. Henry Ford and the Dodge brothers didn't see eye to eye. Now, we think of the Dodge and Ford being different companies, but in 1919, the Dodge brothers were shareholders in Ford Motor Company, and they were minority shareholders. That is, they owned less than half of the stock. Henry Ford was the majority shareholder. The Dodge brothers were upset with Henry Ford because here is what he had to say about his management philosophy. He's quoted by the court in Michigan as saying the following: "My ambition is to employ," Henry Ford said, "still more men to spread the benefits of this industrial system to the greatest possible number, to help them build up their lives and their homes. To do this, we are putting the greatest share of our profits back into the business." He said he thinks Ford Motor Company is making too much money. And can you imagine a corporate exec saying that now? "It has too large profits. And although large profits still may need to be earned, he believes in sharing them with the public by reducing the price of automobiles." He said, "Wouldn't it be great if every line worker could in fact afford an automobile that Henry Ford and Ford Motor Company is making?" That made the Dodge brothers mad. They didn't like that philosophy. They didn't want Ford Motor Company to reinvest in better factories. They didn't want the price of automobiles lowered. They wanted dividends. They wanted a payout from the company. But you know what the court did? The court sided with the Dodge brothers. The court said that Henry Ford could not run Ford Motor Company as a charity. The court said that the object of a business corporation is to earn a profit for shareholders. The powers of the directors are to be employed to that end. The discretion of the directors must be exercised in the choice of a means to attain the end, not to change the end itself. That is the status of American law. That is, that businesses must be operated for the benefits of owners. It's interesting to trace the history of corporate law in the United States. It is said that corporations are relatively new being in the United States. If you go back to 1800, you would find hardly any corporations. If you go back 150 years, for example, when Augustana was founded as a corporation, both the church and the college, it was by legislative charter. You didn't file papers with the Secretary of State. You had to go to the legislature. You had to convince the legislature that these corporations were going to benefit the public interest. Why was that? Why was that in 1860, 1850? Why did you have to go to the legislature to charter a corporation?
Doesn't that trace back to the railroads? Were some of the first charters given to railroads to operate?
Yes, yes. There really was no, there was a suspicion by certainly the public and elected officials of corporations. What is this? It is an unnatural being. It's something that has limited liability. It is not a human being. You can't put it in jail if it doesn't conduct itself right. There was suspicion of allowing individuals to pool money and to act potentially recklessly. So it required a specific charter. Now, with the Industrial Revolution, it became much easier to incorporate a business. And in fact, our corporate law has swung from 150 years ago, being very suspicious of business corporations, to easily enabling business corporations. What do you have to do to start a business corporation now?
$150.
Yeah, $50, $75, $100. File a brief document with the Secretary of State, and you have formed an artificial being. A being that is really accountable to no one other than shareholders, right? If we look at our corporate codes in the United States, how long is a typical corporate code if you strip out the annotations? How many pages would you guess? You're stripping out the annotations.
Well, if you strip out the annotations, corporate code is very thin. Even Delaware code is at most 40, 50 pages, I think.
Yeah, you go to England, you go to Germany, and it would be volume after volume of regulation. But the Model Business Corporation Act, or the Delaware Business Corporation Act, is known as enabling a legislation. It enables corporations to do what they want, so long as they are accountable to shareholders. Well, with that framework, let's take a look at this problem and ask what you might do. And take a look at the unit number one problem. This is the case of Acme Clothing. Acme faces the same dilemma that many American businesses have. You're the CEO of Acme Clothing. It's a manufacturer of men's pants. Like most clothing manufacturers, it's lost substantial money and laid off substantially all 50% of its workforce. It can go to Southeast Asia, and a business agent approaches Acme Clothing and points out that they ought to manufacture pants in Southeast Asia for 50 cents an hour. The going rate in Southeast Asia for wages is, we're going to pay 70 cents an hour, Acme pants. The going rate is 50 cents an hour. The agent says it's great. You don't have to worry about employee benefits. You don't have to worry about employees asserting their rights. They have few. You don't have to worry about environmental regulations. You pay a bribe to the government, that's really all you need to worry about to get started with. For a payment of cash of $50,000, that's all they need to do. They'll get the work permit in 48 hours. What do you do if you're management? The way things are going, Acme Clothing faces bankruptcy within a year. The company has reduced its workforce to 400 employees, 300 in the factory, 100 in the sales in administrative functions. If the company outsources to Southeast Asia, it will save about 75% of the sales jobs and preserve some shareholder value for the shareholders of the corporation. Now, if you're management here, what would you do? What are your duties? Assume it's a small town.
Do we know if it's a corporation with a lot of stockholders or a closely held corporation?
Let's assume that it's a publicly held corporation. That's a good question. Why would that make a difference?
Well, if it's a closely held corporation, you are in effect running your own business. You can do what you want. I mean, you have just a few shareholders, but if you've got thousands of shareholders, then you're in a little different position as to who your royalty has to put.
Right. And, you know, that points up the difference between a closely held corporation and a publicly held corporation. If we look at Middle Eastern countries and Southeast Asian countries, they're all closely held businesses, and it makes it much easier to decide things like this. That is, you sit down and you talk to the owners, usually family members, and you can do the ethical thing, right, if that's what the family wants to do. Can you do the ethical thing here? Can you say we're going to go down with the ship here? This clothing manufacturer has been in the community for years, and we're going to keep it in the community as long as we can. What do you think? How would you approach it?
Oh, as far as community, you go down, the workforce is out, you outsource, the workforce is out. So no win situation for the workforce. So that's one of the
right.
That will happen either way.
Indeed.
Yes.
Good point. You really have no choice here, do you? Do you not? Under if it is a publicly held corporation, you can't say that we've been an important part of this community and we're going to go down with the ship. That violates the duty to shareholders. Now, it may aid the community. Maybe you can hang on for 3 or 4 years. It may aid customers, creditors, suppliers, employees, and the alike. But you really have no choice there. Yes?
Would it be possible to make a different product that did have a higher market?
Might be. Yeah, might be. May also, what happens if this company would say we're going to go out of business here, we're going to stop manufacturing clothing here, but we're going to give the plant to the local university for business development. You think they can do that? Let's assume that the plant has some fair market value. Assume the plant's worth $500,000. Think they can do that?
Not without shareholder approval.
Without shareholder approval? Let's suppose the shareholders say no. I mean, I don't know whether the shareholders would approve something like that or not. I mean, I kind of doubt it. If you look at what shareholders do at annual meetings, it is usually that, which is kind of the maximizing right. profit. Yes?
I'm familiar with the, everybody talks about how corporations are required to make a profit, but you used a different word when you were describing the Ford versus Dodge case, where you were talking about just a public benefit.
Yes.
Can that be defined as other than financial or not just solely financial? What if the stockholders are mostly local people and they also, if you convert it to an employee-owned situation where they have more of a stock and the qualitative benefits?
Yeah, it's very difficult to convert a publicly held corporation to an employee-owned corporation. Sometimes that has been done. I think you may be able to give the plant to the community. It depends upon what the value of the plant is. It depends upon how many plants that you have. Let's delve a little deeper into the law about that. Since Dodge versus Ford, since the court case, which is really the basis of American law, that your duty is to the shareholders, over half of the states have enacted what we call constituency statutes. Those are statutes which have enacted what we call constituency statutes. Those are statutes which, let me read you one here in short from the state of Pennsylvania. This was one of the first constituency statutes enacted in 1983. In discharging the duties of their respective positions, the board of directors and committees of the board may, not required to, may, in considering the best interest of the corporation, consider the effects of any actions on employees, suppliers, customers of the corporation, communities in which offices are located, or other establishments of the corporation, where the corporation is located. Those are constituency statutes. Over half the states now have constituency statutes. Now, the constituency statutes are somewhat limited. You notice they may consider the interest of the community. They may consider the interest of the employees. They are not required to. They may only consider the interest of the community and the employees if it advances the overall corporation. That is a major caveat also. The American Law Institute, which is a group of law professors and leading attorneys, has developed a pronouncement about corporate social responsibility called the Principles of Corporate Governance. Many states have adopted this principle, these principles of corporate governance, particularly the smaller states that don't have well-developed corporate law. Here is what the experts say, and many Supreme Courts say that states may do. When can a corporation consider something other than shareholders? In three instances. Number one, they can consider interest other than the shareholders to the extent that they are required by law to do so. Well, that's not a very, very big exception, is it? So you can consider the interests of shareholders, for example, by paying the minimum wage, because you're required by law to do so. You may take into account ethical considerations. Corporations may take into account ethical considerations that are reasonably regarded as appropriate to the responsible conduct of business. That opens the door toward corporate responsibility a little more. That is, you don't have to only consider the interest of shareholders, but you may take into account ethical considerations that are reasonably regarded as appropriate. And number three, the third exception, is you can obey the law, you can act ethically, and three, you can devote a reasonable amount of resources to public welfare, humanitarian, educational, and charitable purposes. And that is not an insignificant exception. So when you hear corporations say, no, we can't do that because our obligation is to the shareholder, well, yes and no. Yes and no. The primary obligation is to the shareholders, but there are a series of secondary obligations.
But who defines those obligations?
Who defines those obligations?
I mean, you read three principles, but have those been affirmed by courts? Or?
Those have been affirmed by courts. Now, the biggest of those kind of exceptions is the middle exception. It's been pretty well established that if you want to donate a community park, for example, you can do so. Why? Because it elevates the stance of the corporation and the community. There is a tie to profitability. But what if you want to make an ethical decision? That is, you want to do something to protect the environment. You want to comply with environmental standards, but even more so. You want to reduce, let's assume you're complying with the law now, you want to cut your emissions by 75%. Can you do that if that costs the corporation? Well, your question is a good one. Who decides? Let's look at the language of the American Law Institute. You can take into account ethical considerations. Well, reductions of emissions are an ethical consideration. Are they not? That are reasonably regarded as appropriate to the responsible conduct of business. That's a qualifier. It'd be a big red mark on the side. Reasonably regarded by whom? By whom? Is it reasonably regarded by the public? Is it reasonably regarded by the environmental community? Who is it reasonably regarded by? And most courts would say reasonably regarded by similarly situated executives. So it is a reasonable business person standard. So could you cut emissions by 75% if it reduced profitability by 50% under American law? Well, the question is, would corporate executives regard that as reasonable? Probably not.
You could do it, right? You could do it, but you're subject to shareholders coming back.
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
Yeah, you can do
it's
what you want.
It's not illegal to do.
Yeah. Yes, you can do what. It's not illegal to do that, but shareholders may well come back at you. And I would suggest that there are activist shareholders groups that would come back at you. For every kind of group that is monitoring corporate responsibility, there are other groups wanting to maximize profitability.
But if the shareholders agreed to a public image that would be improving the environment or being a responsible player in the environment, wouldn't that be?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. If the shareholders agree to it, you can do it.
That's an interesting
But are the shareholders going to agree to it? Now, let me ask about that. There have been many shareholders' resolutions that have related to environmental responsibility. Usually those shareholders' resolutions are pretty modest, are they not? Accurately reporting your environmental impact and having that audited. Do those ever pass? Not that I know of. So shareholders for publicly held corporations probably won't agree to that. Yes.
Well, and that surfaced in the divestment debates around apartheid.
Yes.
Because the challenge was always whether even the church was going to get sued around pension issues for its members.
Right.
And that was always the threat. I mean, they were, but it seems to me. What I'm wondering about is how do these dynamics then affect the desire of people who have been schooled in a European model? I mean, do they look at getting into American corporate environment with glee because they don't have to deal with all of the kind of regulation?
Well, I think that is an interesting question. American corporate law does not export well. By that, I mean this emphasis on a corporation purely being a contract between the business and its owners to maximize profits does not export well. The Chinese can't understand that. The Japanese can't understand that. The Germans certainly can't understand that, nor can the French. However, there is the need to compete with United States corporations. So until about 10 years ago, stock options to management were illegal in Germany, illegal in Japan. 10 years ago, those nations changed those laws. So we're seeing some creep of American law elsewhere. Mm-hmm. Now, certainly we don't see that into the Middle East. We don't see that into Southeast Asia. But, you know, corporate law can be a race to the bottom. By that, I mean, if we're very lax in the United States to compete with the United States, you need to be very lax also. However, I think there's some good news, and that is there are some evolving corporate standards by different organizations that have had an impact on the way that management looks at corporate responsibility. The Sullivan Principles have had some difference. A lot of corporations have signed on to that. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, in their corporate governance standards, have not bought the United States model hook, line, and sinker. So I see some blending or evolving of a world corporate standard. Well, that's good and bad, I think, because I think the most responsible nations will have their standards watered down a little bit. Our standards might be brought up. One of the problems is that in the United States, we regard a corporation essentially to be contracts with shareholders. Elsewhere in the world, the corporate being is not a contract between shareholders. Rather, it is an organization to benefit the community. The contract model, the communitarian model. Now, the Dodge versus Ford case is about right here. It's a contract between the shareholders and others. I think that the horizon has been pushed here in the United States a little bit away from that. In the jurisdictions, in fact, that have constituency statutes. That is, those state statutes that say you can consider the interests of other constituencies. Likewise, certainly the common law or the court-made law would say that corporations can take into account ethical considerations if they are reasonably regarded by the business community to be within the fair realm of ethical consideration. So we've moved it just a little bit. Yes?
I'm thinking of a couple of companies, the one that everybody likes to beat up with, and Walmart.
Yes. Mm.
And we have a local company in the Seattle area called Costco, which at least kind of goes against their other, you know, Walmart's other company.
Mm-hmm.
But they have a totally different ethic and treatment of employers, for example. And I'm thinking it's true that that you have a contract relationship between the corporation and the stockholders.
Right.
But you also have a contract relationship in some sort of sense with employees. And I'm
right.
Just wondering, if this is fought out, and there's been a lot of challenge or grumbling against Costco because they treat their employees much too well.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see a minority, or I can see a stockholder fight there, and I'm just wondering, this contract with employees, is Costco going to be okay, or are they going to follow the Ford Dodge?
Yes. And you know, that is the question in American law, because some socially responsible corporations are pushing the horizon there a little bit. And that today, which is generally regarded to be responsible ethical conduct within corporations, might be different than it was 20 years ago. And I would suggest that which is generally regarded today as being socially responsible conduct could be quite different than 20 years from now. I'm really encouraged about what's happening in America's colleges and MBA programs to try to push the horizon out a bit with respect to social responsibility. Yes?
Are the people out there researching the business sense of treating employees well? Intuitively, it seems to make sense that if you treat your employees well, there'll be less turnover, they'll stay, you save tons of money in recruiting and training and all that sort of stuff.
Absolutely, and there is research to suggest that, certainly. And if Costco was pushed into court, they would rely on that research. What would they show if they got sued by their shareholders? They would bring in research like that. This is connected to profitability, but even if it's not connected to profitability, they would bring in other corporate executives, people from the business roundtable to say, yeah, you know, in America in 2006, we put a greater premium on taking care of employees. Yes?
Well, it seems like one of the other disconnects is with, if you've got a responsibility to your employees, I agree with that, but then there's also the managers. In some cases, you know, like in Minnesota, we've got United Healthcare,
mm-hmm.
where McGuire, the CEO, had $8 million in compensation. Now, $8 million, right. Shouldn't the shareholders be entitled to that, or the people who this nonprofit company is supposedly serving?
Yeah, what about that? Yeah. What about excessive compensation? How do you stop that?
You made a comment earlier of the 10 years ago that the Japanese, German, English
mm-hmm.
started to where majority stockholders could actually be in management and upper management. Mm-hmm. And so these people who get these large bonuses, I'm sorry, they belong on the owner's side, not on the manager's side.
Yeah.
And there's a conflict. They say, oh, look, I've done such a good job. I get my money. I can vote it. I have 52%.
Mm-hmm.
So they say,
Now, shareholders have been somewhat effective in putting pressure on corporate management to hold down corporate compensation. How has that been done? Sara Lee, for example, the board of Sara Lee, the chair of Sara Lee is on our board of trustees, has her compensation capped. Why did the board do that? Why would they cap her compensation? Seems like the women who are CEOs get their compensation capped in mm-hmm. corporate America, but let's take that out of the equation. Not all the women. It's the pension funds, right? There is shareholder activism. Much of that activism comes from the pension funds, which owns an insurance company, a significant portion of corporate America. They can organize the California pension fund, the New York pension fund, the Illinois, the Ohio pension fund. Now, are they going to organize to help the community? Probably not, because they're under substantial pressure. Many of them have pension payments to make, and the economy and the stock market isn't making it easy. But they certainly can go after managers, and that has been done.
But not very effectively.
What's been going on with top management?
Compensation, not just salaries, over the last decade is astounding.
Yes.
Particularly relative to what workers are making and the shrinkage of employment for people in this country.
What you see when you look at shareholders' resolutions, and it's the Interfaith Center for Corporate Responsibility, get on their website, has cataloged most shareholders' resolutions. Shareholders' resolutions coming from churches, typically mainline denominations, or pension funds. They all fail. They virtually all fail. But those that get the furthest are those that put caps on management compensation. So that is a frontier that is being made, but they don't do anything for the environment. I mean, some of those get 33% of the votes. Sara Lee, to avoid having the shareholders' resolution go forward, negotiated that compromise. Well, then we're left with the question. If corporate management says, no, we can't do that, we can't cut emissions below the standard required by the law. We can't pay customers, we can't pay employees more, we can't make a safer product. That is not necessarily so. They can. Do they have to? They don't have to. And that is the limitation on American law. Now, if you compare the European treatment of employees, particularly in Germany and France, with the American treatment, it's not you may treat employees well, you may give them extraordinary job security, you must give them extraordinary job security. That has its own downsides, too, in a competitive market, but it is that we can't go too far in this direction. We can't injure, under the status of American law, corporate profitability too much, because who's going to be sitting there in the courtroom? Going to be corporate people saying, well, this is reasonable, this isn't a reasonable reasonable piece of ethics. What can we do?
I just have a question about that jury of people who decide what's reasonable in a country with millions of corporations, most of whom don't perform at or above what the market performs. There's some heavy hitters who carry them all, so we all invest in mutual funds, the majority underperform, yet that is the pool from which the people who decide what's reasonable is selected are people who are running corporations who aren't performing at market. Right? You know, their companies may not be losing value, but they certainly aren't keeping value with the market. So it seems kind of like a gun to the head approach to say, well, we're going to have people who don't, we're going to pick a pool of people who are not successful statistically, to decide what's
the
durable.
Yeah,
that seems dangerous.
I think that's right. You know, I would note that many of these cases aren't going to go to a jury, though. Many of these.
No, I mean this business roundtable.
Absolutely.
Most business leaders in this country are idiots. I mean, they're not the brightest. You know, the Peter Principle.
Yeah, let's ask about that though. You know, are most business leaders idiots? Do we think? Certainly, the idiots certainly get the lion's share of publicity. Well,
they didn't get there by accident. So, as far as an idiot, I think we have to describe that. That doesn't mean stupid. That doesn't mean not business smart. I think it would come to ethics and what their responsibility.
Yeah.
To corporate America.
Your point probably is.
As I sit and watch the people who come to influence legislation in the state of California, or who come and try to influence the treasurer to not have our pension fund be an activist pension fund, and these guys are running multi-billion-dollar corporations. You know, Lee Broad.
Right.
Yeah, he's probably very bright, but when you sit across from him, if you just met him, you would think, who is this guy?
Yeah.
Let's ask about that. Let's assume that the company, I don't know whether they're idiots, but are they socially conscious? One could ask, are they socially conscious? Many of them are absolutely not socially conscious. Or if they are, they kind of hide it. You know, they check their social values at work. But let us assume in the hypothetical that a manager of the corporation decides we're going to cut emissions by 75% for our factories. Now, they're already in compliance with the law, so 75% below what the law requires. That is going to reduce profitability by 50%, let us assume. What's going to happen to that corporation? What's going to happen to the stock value of that corporation? It's going to go down. What happens when the stock value goes down?
Shareholders sell.
Shareholders sue. That's a lot of work to sue. They might
not sue.
Sell. Who do they sell to?
To another company at a lower price to get out of it.
Well, it's going to end up in a takeover, is it not? Because what is going to happen there is share prices have been depressed by a socially responsible conduct of the corporation. Shareholders then will sell. Someone like Carl Icahn or others will come in, buy that company at a bargain price. What's the first thing that the takeover company is going to do? Fire management, right? Yeah, fire management.
If that didn't already happen, I would suggest that that's the first thing that would happen, is that manager would be fired, because a company that has earnings that are going down that quickly is looking for a scapegoat.
Absolutely. And for those of you who know or have been involved in large publicly held corporation, their eyes on the stock market from day to day, and you live and die by quarterly results.
Doesn't it depend on the time frame? If you're governed by your quarterly report, you're going to have a terrible time making the case to your stockholders that 10 years out, this environmentally sensitive new factory is going to make a lot of sense because we have 40 years of increasingly restrictive laws, and so it's smart to build it that way now rather than try to retrofit it at 10 times the cost 10 years from now. But we can't do that if you're governed by a quarterly report.
Right. And why are you governed by the quarterly report? You have the analysts out there, and the stock market is very receptive and dependent upon what they think. Yes, and then we'll go over here.
I resonate to his comments about the idiots because on an emotional level, I'm there all the time. I'm yelling at the TV set, I'm yelling at the paper and all the time. But on the other hand, I'm just wondering if a fair comment would be that a lot of them that rise to be a corporate head have gotten there for a variety of reasons, but few of them look at the responsibilities with that type of a lens. In other words, that there's a whole bunch of things that they're supposed to be doing, that they're much narrower, their function is much narrower, and therefore they come up with much narrower decisions.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yes, sir.
This may be extremely naive, but can you imagine a situation where there is enough chaos so that there might be some kind of populist movement that would help redo Ford and Dodge or tweak it? Are there any rumblings or anything?
Oh, I think there may be rumblings. I mean, look at the situation that Ford has gotten itself into right now with the depressed share prices, although I understand there's been a little uptick with poor management decisions being made, many of which relate to the environment, these gas guzzlers. Well, let's ask about that. We painted a hopeless situation here. That is, if you act responsibly, you're going to get fired. Where's the hope?
Well, the hope is in universal health care.
Yes, yeah. Okay.
Because the big difference that I see in the discussion between what's happening in Europe and what's happening here is that companies are going bankrupt over health care costs.
Okay, that's one potential
movement.
Ford
pays, and we're talking about Ford. Ford pays more in health care than they do per car than they do in steel. Okay?
Yeah, it's an amazing statistic. What is it, 2,500 per car or something like that?
Yeah, something like that. But what I'm saying is, maybe something else would replace it. Maybe there'd still be all this, lack of ethics at these high levels. I don't know. I just like to see that our companies have the same opportunities as the European companies.
Sure, that's a good point.
Behave better.
I would expand on that, though. Not only health care, but pension. This Northwest Airlines, one of the reasons why they're in trouble. I mean, they've got many reasons, but one of them is the pensions that they've given to their employees. They can't fund it. People are living longer.
Other hopes here? Is this a hopeless situation? It's not a hopeless situation.
I'd like to throw in a concept that doesn't seem to be on the radar screen in this discussion, which is the whole movement toward socially responsible investing, and the stockholders that would buy into a company that they saw would intentionally make that kind of decision, mm-hmm. and the stockholders that would only invest in a company that followed the, whatever you want to call them, the 3 E's or the socially responsible mm-hmm. Profile. In fact, I'm working with a group of people in my community to find a way for average people who aren't even used to being in the stock market to maybe just open a savings account even, or a certificate of deposit that money would be channeled only to locally owned businesses that commit to a triple bottom line in their business plan. And so then you've got the impacts of the businesses right there in your communities. It's your friends, or it's your job, or it's your health benefits, or your work hours, or your river that's being polluted, or whatever, it's not shipped offshore. It's all right there, and so you're not as concerned with getting rich quick. Mm-hmm. You're concerned about keeping your community's economy going.
It goes one step further, and that's the consumer.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's where it has to really begin.
Absolutely. Yes.
One sign of hope, and this is a little bit different than the corporate, but Portland, Oregon fired all the school custodians 4 years ago and brought in low-cost, mentally challenged people. And just 3 months ago, that was reversed. And so the school custodians are actually going to be back in the buildings. And it's just a small sign that something that has to do with bottom line wouldn't just have its way.
Let me suggest that there is reason for hope. We'll talk a little bit more about the hopeful side tomorrow for those of you who are able to join us. But I do think social norms are changing. I think the younger generation has a much different view of the environment, a much different view of product safety. I think they need to be fostered in that regard, because the younger generation, it strikes me, still enjoys quite a bit of materialism and creature comfort. But as societal norms change, the corporate boardroom will change also. That is a sign of hope. Until then, we cannot rely on corporate management, in my opinion, to protect stakeholders as we should. We need a strong system of laws. That is, we need to maintain strong labor laws, strong bankruptcy laws, strong laws concerning antitrust, strong tax laws, strong environmental laws. If this is basically a contract between shareholders and the corporation, and not a contract with the community, we need to rely on a strong system of laws. I would also say that as a sign of hope, corporate codes of social responsibility are on their face getting to be better and more aggressive than years past. On their face, they're getting to be better. In actuality, are they? We'll talk a little bit more about that next week, but the beginnings are there, in my judgment, in many corporate codes. If you look at Nike's code, Avon's code, it's a pretty good code. Are they enforced? Are they treated seriously? Is a separate question. I do think socially responsibility among investors has some potential. I don't think it's making a lot of difference right now.
But it could. I think corporations understand the market better than anything else. And if the market's values shift, then we don't buy stock in those corporations. So nobody is interested in keeping them going.
What we will find as we discuss this in the coming week is that value shift is the best answer to this problem. I've said that we ought to have a strong system of laws, but think about the practicality of that. With the corporate bar employed in part to find loopholes in those laws, with our system of lobbying and the relatively strong role of corporations, the best solution certainly is a shift in the social norms. And we see that among these young people here at Holden Village. What if one of them is a president of General Motors someday? Will this experience have any impact on them? I should think so. A couple of closing comments before we go to worship. Yes?
Your comment about France and other countries with a different system, I know a person fairly well who is an employer in Germany. And I spoke with him several months ago when he was visiting over here. And he was bemoaning the fact, because he's a very socially responsible employer. He really is. But he was bemoaning the fact that he is so caught up with the law in Germany as to the way it treats employees, he cannot hire employees that he really desperately needs and wants to do, because as soon as he does, he has this all kinds of costs. And if he hires enough people to do the work he needs to do, it's going to kill him, his business. So we had some interesting discussion. I never heard it that way before.
And in fact, you know, the studies will show that a formation of capital for entrepreneurs is almost non-existent in Germany. There's not a merger or takeover market to speak of in Germany. Now, there's some exceptions to that. So Germany scores well with respect to how employees are treated. But what about formation of capital, the ability to compete in a way that you can keep the factory door open?
And the resulting unemployment.
Right.
You know, it's easy to blame the employers for not hiring, but he's the employer that wants to hire them.
We're going to talk a little bit next week about blending the U.S. system, which is good at formation of capital and creating jobs, with the European, Chinese, and Southeast Asian systems, learning something from Middle Eastern countries to ask whether we can have an international code of social responsibility. Yes.
Last hopeful note, there's a coalition that just started a couple months ago in the Bay Area. I think it's 8 counties that are banding together at all imaginable levels to operate in a sustainable manner and yes. to adopt sustainable business practices and local focus and local businesses and yes. all the way from food to manufacturing. It's just, it's really, really going to be exciting. Michael Schumann, author of Going Local, was working with them on that, and I'm really excited to see that.
Well, let's close now. Tomorrow morning, for those of you who care to attend, we'll be talking about what consumers can do, a little more about what shareholders can do. If you are a socially responsible employee at a company, what you can do and how you can extend your reach beyond the company you're employed with. So we're starting with the problem, and we'll come up with a solution tomorrow. Next week, we'll get into much more detail on corporate codes of ethics and shareholder resolutions. Thank you all.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you.